right. I know we have a lot of families with young kids here at our church, so I don't want to brag too much, but both of my kids are pretty good sleepers. Pretty good. They do a good job. They sleep through the night once you get them there. But that's the issue, right? They hate the idea of sleep. They hate the idea of, like, I just have to sit still for how long? Every night when I put my son to bed, like, as I'm leaving, he's like, okay, how long do I have to sleep? Like he's going to be able to, like, manage that. I'm like, and I have to say, it's like 100 Bluey episodes, probably way more than that. You know, we measure time in Bluey episodes at our house. But yeah, they're pretty good sleepers, but they hate the idea of sleep. To them, sleep feels like they're missing out on life. Why sleep when we can play or watch another show or keep having fun, right? And every once in a while, they convince us and we let them stay up late. We let them skip a nap. And it always goes the same way, right? We think, all right, we're being cool. We're letting them stay up. They're thrilled at first. They think they found more life. And then eventually they crash, right? And they melt down. They become exhausted and emotional, irrational, honestly pretty mean little humans, right? It's like, who are you? It's like the scene, we always joke, it's like the scene in Lord of the Rings whenever Bilbo's like fine, he's like, ah, you know? It's like, where did this come from? But this very thing they thought was going to be giving them more life is actually draining it from them. This thing that they thought was going to be giving them more life or more time or more control is actually, you know, consuming them. It's draining them. And honestly, we do the same thing all the time, right? We make those choices. Like, if you had time away from it, you might make a better choice. But in the moment, right, you make the thing that you think is best for you. You do the thing that you think is going to give you more life, even if, you know, if you really looked at it, you'd know that's probably not the best choice for me. Have you noticed that the things that promise the most life eventually leave us the most drained most often? Maybe it's a promotion that still leaves you empty and busier than you can imagine. Maybe it's getting at the end of the day and just on TV, going to the next thing, or scrolling on your phone to rest, but somehow it just leaves you more anxious and more exhausted. Maybe it's just constant distraction, that you just need to constantly be distracted and it leaves you numb. Maybe it's comfort that slowly turns into isolation. You say, I need my time, I need my time. And then eventually, it's just all your time and you're not spending time with anybody else. Why do the things that promise life leave us empty? And you have to ask yourself, what do you run to when you're tired, when you're stressed, lonely, bored, insecure, when you're angry? What do you keep returning to even though it never actually satisfies you? What promises relief and leaves you emptier afterward? Where do you feel stuck in cycles? Last week, Jeff talked about the flesh, this idea that goes all throughout the New Testament. Paul talks about it. Other writers talk about it, the flesh. And what exactly that means when they're talking about it. And really, it's this idea of how sinful desires, our sinful needs, our wants in the moment, our fleshly, mortal, things that will just satisfy a need in that moment, how those override our deepest desires. Our sinful desires override our deepest desires, and they slowly shape us into people we never intended to become. Like people that we don't want to be, but over time, one decision after another shapes us into someone we would never have chosen. And to see it, and Paul even talks about how in his own life, sin has a way of leading him off course. He says something to the effect of, I do what I don't want to do, and I don't do what I do want to do. It's one of my favorite passages because he says do like a couple times. That's the youth pastor in me, right? But it's also relatable. It's like, I've been there, right? Like, I've been in that moment when, like, I don't do what I want to do. I keep doing this thing that I know is wrong for me. But here in Romans 8, we started in Romans 8 last week, and we're going to kind of keep going through it this whole month. Here in Romans 8, he talks about, he begins to unveil this kind of, this battle that's happening inside of us, this internal battle, and how instead of going down the path that leads to death, he points us to the glory and hope we have as followers of Christ. how before Christ, it was a losing battle. It was hardly a battle at all, that you were always going down the road to death. But because of Christ, the path to life has been opened. And so Paul, he doesn't just diagnose the emptiness of life and sin, he explains it. He says there are actually two ways to live. He says you can live according to the flesh or according to the spirit. And that's what's being compared here. Living according to the flesh or living according to the spirit. And I want to make one distinction here talking about the flesh. We kind of defined it last week. But I think there's an important thing. It's easy to read the flesh here and come away with just like a negative view of the body or earthly life in general. Like we just take the flesh and kind of what we know about it, and we don't know exactly how they're using it, and we might read in some things that they wouldn't have meant. We might come away with this really negative view of embodied life. And to see it all, we might see the body as so corrupted by sin that it's all just a wash, and we need salvation. And the salvation that we receive in Jesus is actually an escape from the body. Sometimes that gets taught, or it gets understood as you're reading, that really, like, following Jesus is the way that I escape, you know, my body, or like I escape the physical life or all the evils of this world. It's like an escape, ultimately. But that's a misunderstanding. That's a misunderstanding of what the biblical authors want. That's not really what the Bible teaches. It comes from this idea of treating the body like it doesn't matter, as though your soul is the real you and your body is just like a temporary shell. And that's really like a Greek philosophy, like I think Aristotle idea. That's not like a Bible idea, but it's infected in how we think about ourselves, how we think about our soul and our body and mind. But the Bible, it really tries to, from the beginning, talk about all of those things as the whole person. And they all make up you, your body, your soul, your mind, your heart. All of that is you. It's not like one has more meaning or matters more than the other. You are you. The biblical story from beginning to end values embodied life. And the gospel is not a salvation that asks you to untether yourself from humanity. There are a bunch of false gospels, other religions, other things that try to tell you the right way to live, that say that that's the way to true life, is to untether yourself from your humanity, or that the way to have a fuller or better life is to untether yourself from all the things of this world. But that's not true. That's not what the gospel we believe in says. Actually, in youth group over the past couple months, we've been talking about this idea that sin isn't what makes us human. It's actually what makes us less human. Humanity was created before sin. It lived in a reality that where sin didn't exist, yet it's been corrupted. There was a way for humans to live and to be that had no part in sin. And so often we come to the thought or the belief that our sin is just what makes us us. Like, this is part of being human. This is part, and yes, it's part of our experience of being human, but it's not part of what God intended for us. Sin makes us less human. And Jesus became human to make us fully human again in a way that only he could. His spirit in us puts our corrupted, sinful nature to death and restores us to full human life. And that's what Paul is getting at here in this next section of Romans 8. That life in the flesh consumes us, but life in the spirit restores us. And it all comes down to how we're oriented, who we're facing, what we're running towards. So what does fully human life in the spirit look like? Let's read starting in verse 3, chapter 8. The law of Moses was unable to save us because of the weakness of our sinful nature. So God did what the law could not do. He sent his own son in a body like the bodies we sinners have. And in that body, God declared an end to sin's control over us by giving his son as a sacrifice for our sins. And he did this so that the just requirement of the law would be fully satisfied for us, who no longer follow our sinful nature, but instead follow the Spirit. So, I mean, notice here, this section, he's saying that he sent his own son in a body like the bodies we sinners have. And in that body, God declared an end to sin's control. Paul, he's not saying here that the body itself is evil. I mean, how could he, right? God put on a body. God put on flesh. Jesus put on a body. How could the body itself be sinful? Because Jesus had a real human body, real emotions, real desires, real exhaustion, yet remained fully surrendered to the Father as a human. Which means humanity is not the enemy, sin is. And that's an important thing for ourselves. If we view humanity as the enemy, well then, anytime we sin, it just heaps more guilt and shame on top of us. But if sin is the enemy, then we don't identify with that sin anymore. That's not us. That's sin in me. That's sin corrupting me, but that is not who I am. And also, as we look out in the world around us, it's really easy to look at the people that we disagree with or the people that are we see as our enemies or actually are our enemies that are fighting against us and to look at them and say that they are an enemy. But really, humanity is not the enemy. Sin is. Even in the person that you despise the most, sin has corrupted them. Every person in this room. Sin is the enemy. Humanity is not the enemy. And that matters because many people think that Jesus, following Jesus, means becoming less human. It might mean suppressing desire or killing personality or escaping physical life. And there might be some, you know, suppressing of some sort. You might have to run away from some things, but it's more of a surrender, right? See, Jesus is the most fully human person who ever lived. And when you look at his life, he was always with people. He was not hiding, shying away from what it meant to be human or to have a lived experience. The Spirit's goal is not to erase your humanity, but to restore it. And Jesus shows us what human life with the Spirit actually looks like. He is not only the clearest revelation of God. Like, he's not the thing that we see that shows us who God is the most. He's not only that, but he's also the clearest revelation of what humanity looks like when it's fully alive in God. He is the truest vision of what it means to be human. And this helps explain why Jesus constantly frustrated the religious people of his day. It's because his holiness didn't look like a withdrawal from humanity, but full communion with the Father in the middle of ordinary life. Jesus revealed that life with God is not about who you're oriented away from, but it's about who you're oriented towards. And the Pharisees, they were obsessed with avoiding contamination, who they wanted to run away from or hide away from. But Jesus set his mind on communion with the Father. And that's the difference between life in the flesh and life in the Spirit. Are you trying to run away from all the things that are, you know, trying to corrupt you? Are you just so worried about the things that are corrupting? Are you actually oriented around those things that are corrupting? Or are you oriented around the Father in communion with him? The flesh curves inward on itself, and the Spirit draws us outward toward God and to the people around us and loving. And it might look the same sometimes, but the inward position, how you're oriented, makes all the difference. The one who leads to death, or one leads to death while the other leads to life and peace. Let's keep reading in verse 5. Those who are dominated by the sinful nature think about sinful things, but those who are controlled by the Holy Spirit think about things that please the Spirit. So letting your sinful nature control your mind leads to death, but letting the Spirit control your mind leads to life and peace. For the sinful nature is always hostile to God. It never did obey God's laws, and it never will. That's why those who are still under the control of their sinful nature can never please God. See, the flesh, it always presents itself as life-giving, but in reality, it's always oriented towards death. And I think the line that he says there at the end, in verse 8, he says, that's why those who are still under the control of their sinful nature can never please God. That can seem like a really terrifying thing to say, but what he's getting at there is this idea that if you are living in your sinful nature, even if you're doing things that might be good, if you're doing them with a orientation towards the flesh and not towards God, orientation towards how you look or your mortal life or something like that. If you're oriented around things of death, even when you're trying to do something good, it's not going to please God. But if you're doing those things oriented around God, then it will please him. It always presents itself as life-giving, but it's always really oriented towards death. See, and it's not always an immediate physical death, what I'm saying. I'm not talking about physical death here. I'm talking about spiritual decay. The Bible believes that you can die spiritually long before you die physically. It might look like numbness or emptiness or isolation or shame or loss of peace or disconnection from God. In verse 6 there where it says, the sinful nature leads to death, but letting the Spirit control your mind leads to life and peace. It might seem like, what's that? The peace seems like an extra thing there, right? Like death and life, those are obviously opposites. But the peace there is important. Because it's not just saying peace with others, I'm sure that's involved, but it's saying peace with God. When you're living in a life that's oriented around the flesh, when you're choosing to follow after those types of things, or in that kind of mindset, you are at war with God. You are at war with what God wants in your life. And it may seem like a dramatic way to say that, but if you are not living in the way that God has designed you to live, in the best way to live, if he created you, he knows the best way for you to have a rich and full life. And if you are at war with him, then you can't be at peace with him. If you are choosing death, then you can't be at peace with life. The flesh, it doesn't just tempt us, it consumes us. If everything in your life is oriented around what's mortal and perishable, and if that might seem like a vague thing, here's some examples. If it's oriented around your comfort, your security, your finances, your appetites, your lust, your popularity, your boredom, your status, or even your own righteousness, then even good things can become pathways to death in your life. Even good things, if they become ultimate things, can become pathways to death in your life. Because anything disconnected from the life of God eventually withers. Paul says that the mind governed by the flesh is death. And it's not because every physical thing is evil, but it's because a life curved inward on itself cannot produce life. It can't produce the peace that we're made for. Keep reading in verse 9. He says, but you were not controlled by your sinful nature. Here's the hope, right? You are not controlled by your sinful nature. You are controlled by the Spirit if you have the Spirit of God living in you. And remember that those who do not have the Spirit of Christ living in them do not belong to him at all. And Christ lives within you, so even though your body will die because of sin, the Spirit gives you life because you have been made right with God. The Spirit of God, who raised Jesus from the dead, lives in you. And just as God raised Christ Jesus from the dead, he will give life to your mortal bodies by the same Spirit living within you. He finishes here. Therefore, dear brothers and sisters, you have no obligation to do what your sinful nature urges you to do. For if you live by its dictates, you will die. But if through the power of the Spirit you put to death the deeds of your sinful nature, you will live. That's the hope, right? There is a life that's curved inward. There's a life that's curved towards death. But there's hope. There's hope. When you look at what Paul says next, he says, you're not controlled by your sinful nature. You're controlled by the Spirit if you have the Spirit of God living in you. And this is one of the most important shifts in the passage, right? Because he's saying sin may fight for your attention, but it's no longer your master. It doesn't control you anymore. You're no longer trapped in a cycle of trying to manufacture life from things that are slowly consuming you. And why? It's because the same Spirit that raised Jesus from the dead lives in you. And we can sometimes say that as Christians, that we hear that all the time, that Christ's Spirit, the one that raised him from the dead, lives in us. But like, either you don't believe that Jesus actually was raised from the dead, or you do, and sometimes we just like make so little of the fact that that Spirit lives in us. Like, the same power that raised someone who was dead for 3 days is now the same power that lives in us. How can we just like sit like, oh yeah, that, okay, sure. Like, that's crazy. It's radical. The Spirit of God is not just helping you behave better, like we so often think. Like, he's just like your conscience, like telling you like, hey, probably wouldn't do that. Like, yeah, that's probably happening sometimes, but the Spirit of God is not just there for behavior management. He's restoring your life where sin brought death. Where sin corrupted your humanity, he's restoring you to full human life in the way that God meant for you. And that's why Paul says the Spirit gives life to your mortal bodies. If we believe that eternity has already made its home in the body of Christ, which we do, then we can believe that eternity now lives in us through the Spirit of Christ. And not someday only, but now. The Spirit begins restoring in us our desires and our minds and our relationships and our peace and our ability to love and our communion with God. He reshapes us in a way that is ultimately what it will be like in heaven, eternity, now in us, as God intended. It's not behavior modification. This is resurrection life breaking into normal human life. Because the Spirit lives in you, you are no longer obligated to obey the flesh. And what's so hard about this, right? We're saying it's not what you do, it's what the Spirit does. Is that on the outside, it might look the same. It might look like righteousness, but on the inside, it'll feel like resurrection. I'm sure many of you have gone through the times where you've really done your best to be righteous. You've worked really hard, and it just wears you out, and then you fail, and there's so much shame and guilt on top of that. But I promise that there is a way where you surrender yourself to the Spirit, and as you're following him, you'll start living in a way that you don't totally understand, and you have the power and ability to say no to the things that you used to say yes to and be tempted by, and you'll have a power to do that in a way that doesn't make sense, like you're a new person, and it's not coming from you. And it comes from this freedom of knowing that it's not your doing. It's not your job to do it, that you can't do it, actually. You are unable to live up to the law of Moses. You're unable to live up to what God has called us to. But through his Spirit, through an outside power, you actually can. You have no obligation to obey the flesh, but the flesh still makes promises. It pulls, it tempts, but you do not owe it your obedience anymore. Before Christ, sin consumed you, but now the Spirit is restoring you. And if there's one thing that I want you to take away today, it's this, it's that the flesh consumes us, but the Spirit restores us. In those moments when you're having to make those decisions, when you're pressed with something that is ultimately going to consume you, remember that it's temporary, that it will consume you, but you have a choice and a power to resist it, a power that can redeem you and restore you. The flesh consumes, but the Spirit restores. And this might sound like a lot of nice talk. Like, I've been there. Like, okay, great. But in those moments, it's a lot harder to say no than what this is making it out to be, right? It's a lot harder to make the choice that you need to make than this is making it out to be. I mean, and also, if the Spirit does all the work, like, if it's not anything I do, if it's all the Spirit, like, then what am I supposed to do, right? What does any of this mean? Like, because the gospel's not a gospel that calls us to inaction. It's not a life that's saying, hey, just don't do anything, it'll all be handled for you, right? That's not what we're supposed to do. I think there are a few steps, and concrete steps that we can take to live and walk in the Spirit. Paul says, the mind governed by the flesh is death. And so the first step is you have to identify what is consuming you. What are the things in your mind that are consuming you? I think it's helpful to write this down, because if you just try to do this in your head, you'll come up with the first easy option and move on. But if you actually have to create a list, you'll probably get to a truth there. And I'd encourage you, sit down, get a piece of paper, and try to write down, what are the things that have been governing my mind lately? What am I turning to for comfort? What do I believe will finally make me feel alive? What has my attention or my affection? And I think this is even a big one. What has my imagination? What am I dreaming about? What am I thinking about all the time? Because wherever you continually orient your life around will shape you. Some of us, I think, are exhausted because we keep asking temporary things to carry eternal weight in our lives. We're looking to achievement, or comfort, or lust, or distraction, or success, or approval, or control, even maybe religious performance. That if I just do this all the right way, or I live righteously, or I do this, like if I can do enough, then I'll be okay. Then I'll find meaning and purpose in a fuller life. But the flesh cannot restore what the flesh destroys. And this is where following Jesus becomes like really practical. To walk in the Spirit, it means surrendering your life back to God, piece by piece. We try to make surrender like a huge all-in-one thing, but it's just way more work than that. To think that you can just surrender and like have it all be done, like surrendering is a lifelong process. And every day there's going to be something new. Every year there's going to be something deeper that you'll have to surrender. Maybe it'll be your attention or your desires or habits or relationships or thought patterns or your body or your ambitions or even your wounds that you have to surrender over to God. And it's not because humanity is bad, but it's because sin has distorted what God has created for life. And as we surrender those things to God, our lives begin to reorient around the Spirit, and He begins to bring life to our mortal bodies. And notice, Paul doesn't say try harder. You'll never see Paul say that. He never says just try harder in your flesh, but he says to set your mind on the Spirit. It's all about how you orient yourself. And when you set your mind on the Spirit restores us when we stop numbing ourselves long enough to actually be with God. The Spirit restores us when we do the hard work of staying connected to fellow believers. And it's hard work. Sometimes it's easier to not stay connected. Sometimes it's easier to put up a wall, to feign some sort of relationship. But it's hard work to actually invite other people into your lives. But the Spirit restores us when we do that. The Spirit restores us when we're intentional about what voices are shaping our imaginations, about what voices are shaping our worldviews and how we look at the world. When we're intentional about that, the Spirit restores us. Also, when we learn to see the goodness of God in our everyday lives and how His kingdom is breaking into our homes and schools and offices we find ourselves in. When we orient ourselves around what He's doing in the world. And yes, there's a dying that's involved in following Jesus. There's a dying. I'm going to call the band to come back up. There's a dying that's involved in following Jesus. He calls us to deny ourselves, to take up our crosses. Paul says that we were to put our deeds of sin to death, right? He says, He says, put to death the deeds of your sinful nature. Put them to death. He calls us to deny ourselves, take up our crosses, but we're not dying to what makes us human. We're dying to the things that are killing us, the things that are consuming us, the things that are making us less human. Every day, something is shaping you. Something is discipling your desires. Something is teaching you where life comes from, and the flesh will always overpromise and underdeliver. It will consume you while convincing you that it's saving you. But the Spirit leads to life. Real life, full life, maybe life that you've never experienced before. So many of us live our lives being offered a fake version of life, and we just take it. In fact, our desires and our wants have been trained to want that over the real thing. But the Spirit offers us real life, restored life, the kind of life we're actually created for. Pray with me. Dear God, I pray